get yourself a song to sing and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Sing the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, the show Alternative Visions. Today's show, we're going to talk about the topic of single-payer health care, a.k.a. Medicare for all. And, of course, that can't be discussed without talking about it in relationship to the current ACA, Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, and comparing the two. And discussing the current condition of the latter, ACA, and why we need single-payer Medicare for all as the only solution, as it becomes increasingly clear, as this ACA is a stopgap, a very expensive stopgap solution to the crisis of health care in the U.S. Okay, and my guests, we're fortunate today to have a special guest here, Mark Dudzik. Mark is the national coordinator for the labor campaign for single payer. Okay, this is the guy who's heading up the movement here for single payer among union forces and worker forces in the U.S. Mark's been a union activist for 30 years since he began as a member of Local 149 of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers, now the United Steelworkers Union, back 30 years ago, and served as the local president of that union after its founding, and also later the president of the district council of the OCAW. Also before that, his role as a national coordinator today, Mark was also a leading union figure in promoting the Labor Party in the U.S. here in the 1990s, and maybe we'll have him back on a subsequent show to talk about that experience, since all you listeners know we are very much in favor of some kind of a third-party solution to the crisis. Actually, a second party. There is only one party here with two wings. One's called the Republicans, one's called the Democrats, and within the Republicans, we got a faction called the Tea Party. And really, only one party running this country for quite some time. We need another party of some kind, whether it's a Labor Party or whatever, but some kind of new progressive party that will shake up this dominant control of the single party of the big corporations in this country. Okay, let's talk about this topic of single payer, a.k.a. Medicare for all. What is it? What's happening with regard to the movement for it? Why is it necessary now more than ever, as it's becoming increasingly obvious of the faults and limits of the Obamacare proposal that's recently been partially, at least, implemented? As you know, on this show, we've had at least several shows on this topic, related topic, and some of these faults becoming increasingly obvious are, first of all, the monthly cost to those who are signing up on this are not insignificant. Deductibles, premiums, co-pays, right? It's not cheap, even with the so-called reimbursements, subsidies, which is a problem. And we've talked about that. I'm not going to go over that. But, you know, just to give you all a sense of the cost to the recipients here, the so-called middle silver plan, the average deductible for a silver plan on Obamacare is $3,138. Okay? That's a lot of deductibles per year. And when I talk about copays and what's covered and what isn't and the premiums, and I know for a fact because I have family members who whose premiums doubled, and the coverage did not double. It was about the same, but the premiums doubled. In other words, the health insurance companies love this thing because they just double their cost and pay out the same kind of benefits. So a lot of folks are paying double premiums for nothing more, and they have to because there's nowhere else they can go So, the cost to the average person of this ACA is not insignificant. It's gone up. The other problem with it is, we had 50 million people uninsured, and yes, that's gone down. We got, 8-9 million who are insured. That's 40 million people still not insured. This plan cost, this program, ACA, will cost citizens, taxpayers, and others $1 trillion. $1 trillion over the coming decade, and only one-fifth of the people who are uninsured are covered. Now, that's not a success, as far as I'm concerned. Right? That's a very expensive boondoggle for the insurance and drug companies. We had Deb Silverstein on our show a few months ago, and she called this correctly a health insurance corporation subsidy bill. That's exactly what it is. The penalties and the destruction that this plan program will mean for union employer negotiated health plans is really obvious. As we've said before, by 2018, there will be a 40% excise tax slapped on union negotiated health care plans. That means the end of union health care bargaining. Those plans are going to melt away starting before and rapidly when 2018 hits. It's a way of destroying a union employer negotiated health plans. Millions of people are on these plans. Of course, the cost of those have been going up, too. But this is really a way of privatizing health care. You know, George Bush tried to do it with his health savings accounts, privatize health care. And, of course, Bill Clinton before that with managed care, HMOs and all that stuff, right? Managed care. It's all about privatization, just as we've privatized and destroyed union-negotiated pension plans almost. By pushing people in 401ks, HSAs, whatever, and now Obamacare is in that tradition of privatizing health coverage in this country, which means raising the price and fattening the wallets of the health insurance companies. And, of course, even this ACA still, in addition, union members who would be eligible because of their low pay can't get the subsidies from it. Obama has said, no, we're not giving it to you, even though you're eligible. Simply because you got a union plan. So it's a big penalty. It's a way of driving people who are not making a lot of money, you know, in service industries who have union contracts, out of those union contracts as well. And then we have exemptions for millions of small businesses and larger businesses as well for the last couple of years. No exemptions for individuals, but exemptions for the companies. Hmm? Healthcare costs continue to rise. Yes, healthcare spending continues to rise. A recent survey, only 5% of people surveyed, contrary to all the spin that you hear in the business press, only 5% think that healthcare costs aren't rising. So healthcare costs obviously are rising under this bill. And just a couple of months ago, as we reported before, plans of health insurance companies to raise their premiums by, on average, 10%. This coming year, and in some states, 30%. So we're back to the problem of runaway health care costs, which is the big problem with the health care system in this country. People can't afford it anymore. So the ACA and all these other solutions are all designed to ration it. Ration health care costs, use less of it, and that way hold down costs. That's the solution of the corporate party in this country to the health care cost crisis. Ration it. Use less of it. That way we'll keep it down, keep the cost down a little bit, or at least it'll appear that on paper. You'll pay more in insurance company costs and deductibles and so forth, but you will get less of a coverage and less frequently. And they'll say, oh, we're holding down the health care costs because people just won't be able to afford to use it as much. Okay. So that is my rant here on this problem. Gross problem, growing problem that we will see with Obamacare ACA. And the big risk is, as this thing gets into more and more trouble over the years and collapses, it will open the door for the right wing to push even further privatization. You know, Paul Ryan and all those clowns up there in Washington, it'll give them a great opening to even privatize it more. They'll say, oh, Obamacare is a collapsed proposal here, it's not working, so therefore we need vouchers for everybody or something like that, right? Yes, it'll go even further towards privatization. That's why we need Medicare for all. as the solution to this problem of the failure, the growing failure of the ACA over time has become increasingly apparent. If we don't, it's going to result in a further conservative, reactionary, privatization, market-based, more people won't be able to afford it, healthcare system in this country. Okay, that's my rant. And we're going to now talk about this in more detail, give you the real facts with Mark Dudzik. But before we do that, I just want to give an announcement here. Next week's show, I'm going to be talking about my economic predictions once again for the coming year. As you know, I have talked about this once a year on this show based upon an in-depth article I write once a year for Z Magazine. And next week, I'm going to be reviewing my predictions of 2013-14, as well as making predictions for the coming year. Now, this is going to be an interesting show because, as you know, if you've been following the news globally here, the Eurozone is in a triple-dip recession. Once again, Japan's GDP collapsed almost 7% in the second quarter. Of course, the U.S. collapsed almost 3% in the first quarter, a little bit of a bounce back in the second quarter, as I said on our show last week, analyzing that, but in that analysis showed that it's going to slow down again. China's introducing a third stimulus just to keep its GDP from falling. So the picture globally is not very pretty, and then, of course, we have all this stuff going on in the Ukraine, which may just be the coup de grace to the Eurozone economy here. So next week we're going to talk about my economic predictions. Stay tuned for that in some detail. But let's get back to the topic at hand. Mark, are you with us, I hope?
Jack.
Okay, yes. Thanks for coming on. As I said to our audience here, I don't think there's anyone better can explain what's going on with single payer, why it's necessary, and where it's going. And I believe there's a conference coming up, too, that I want you to plug here. But let's just start with the general question. You know, where is the single-payer movement, a.k.a. Medicare, which I like to call it, today? What's happening?
Well, you know, I think you've kind of really laid out a lot of the concerns and the problems with the Affordable Care Act. You know, and all of this really comes down to looking at the two different ways that you can look at health care. You know, we live in a system that views health care as a commodity and treats it and runs it as a business. And that's really, you know, the fundamental problem that people face when they try to get access to health care. And, you know, all of the problems that people have with health care are really kind of derived from that dynamic, you know, the fact that it's run for profit, not for the benefit of people, and that profit considerations dictate both where money is spent in healthcare and who has access to healthcare. The fact that it's incredibly fragmentized because these are, you know, independent businesses often competing with one another and with their own particular interests to maximize their profit. And then the massive inefficiency of the healthcare system, where we in the U.S. spend twice what any other industrialized nation in the world spends for healthcare coverage, and we don't get very good outcomes. As you know, we rank about 27th in the listing of the quality of healthcare and the outcomes of healthcare in this country. So that's
let me jump in on that for the audience here and let them know, you know, when you say twice as much as every other advanced economy, what we're talking about is like 18% of GDP or something like that, which is almost $3 trillion a year. We spend $3 trillion a year, and as you say, we rank 27th. That's not a well-run business.
And, you know, the economist Dean Baker has done some real interesting studies to show that there would be absolutely no federal budget deficit if we spent per capita on health care what any other country in the world spends per capita on health care. And that's just such a powerful number, you know, when you look at that. I mean, you know, you're talking about a austerity movement, which is talking about cutting food stamps and education and closing post offices and laying off workers as a way to deal with a budget deficit. And you could solve it by making health care a right for everybody in America. It's just so so powerful a narrative about you know, the differences between a for-profit healthcare system and a healthcare system that treats healthcare as a public good. And that's really our vision. That's what really single payer is all about. And you know, it's kind of a wonky term, but you know, basically, it says that if you recognize healthcare as a human right and not as a commodity, and you treat it as a public good, the same way that you would treat fire protection. You don't buy, you know, you don't have 50 different fire companies that sell you policies to come to your house, and if your house is on fire, you call up the fire department and they come and put your house, your fire out at your house, or libraries, or education. I mean, these are public goods, and healthcare clearly falls within that range. So if that's the vision of what healthcare should be, then the only real alternative is some kind of a single-payer system, like Medicare. Medicare is a single-payer system for people over 65. You choose your doctors, and you know, you and your doctor then choose your other healthcare providers, and the government pays through a system of social insurance. People pay into this over their working life. Their employer makes a contribution, and it's a matter of right. When you turn 65, you have health care coverage for the rest of your life, and that really needs to be improved and expanded to everybody in America. And you know, the principles are that the system needs to be publicly financed, with those who can afford to pay paying the most, and those who can least afford to pay paying the least. So a system of progressive public financing has to dominate it. There has to be a single standard of care for everybody, so that you don't have incremental access to health care based on how much money you have and your ability to buy your way to the head of the line or to the best institutions. And there has to be no financial bar to care, which is the exact opposite of all of these skin in the game incentives that they're trying to put into both public and private health care right now, which is to say that, you know, people have to pay more and that therefore they'll be better consumers. Anybody who studied the system knows that, in fact, what happens when you create financial barriers is you restrict access to health care and people get sicker and don't get the care that they need. So that's the vision. And, you know, the trouble with the Affordable Care Act is that it's tried to expand health care coverage without changing the nature of the health care system. And it's like putting this round peg of, you know, health care as a human right into this square hole of health care as a business. And it's incapable of doing that. I mean, I want to make clear that, you know, there are certain improvements that the Affordable Care Act has made in terms of access to health care. And it's important to recognize that millions more have health care today that wouldn't have had it otherwise. Workers, to some degree now, because of the guaranteed issue, have a, you know, can quit a job and know that they can buy a private health care insurance policy on the state exchange, even if they have pre-existing conditions or someone in their family has been ill. So there's, you know, certain benefits to this bill, but it really doesn't fundamentally change the nature of the healthcare crisis that almost.
Yeah, the way I look at this at the ACA, as you said, there are a few benefits here and there, you know, sweeteners, as we would call it in union negotiating terms. Mm-hmm. But you know, what are you paying for this? You're paying huge $1 trillion, and are you really solving the fundamental problems of runaway health care costs? As I said, you know, double-digit premiums are starting again, right back where we were once the law is passed. You know, the health insurance companies held back while it was being passed because they love this bill, a lot of money for them. But now that the bill is passed and implemented, now they're starting to raise it again, so they don't solve the problem. And we only have 8, 9, 10 million or 50 million people uninsured who have been solved, and it's costing us $1 trillion. Now, that's it fundamentally. That's the problem fundamentally. It's not that okay, you got to honor pre-existing conditions and so forth. That's not the problem. And another big problem with this bill is while they're expanding Medicaid, okay, which is better than going to emergency rooms for folks, you know, Medicaid, for anyone who's been on Medicaid, is no big shakes. Medicaid, you don't have the right to go to your doctor that you want. The availability of doctors who will take Medicaid patients is very, very low. Very few who will take Medicaid patients, and usually this is the bottom of the barrel of the skilled physicians and clinics availability in this country. So it's a bare bones. Medicaid's bare bones, better than an emergency room, but it sure not go to the doctor of your choice and, you know, look up who's the good doctors and who's not. No, that doesn't exist at all with Medicaid. Medicaid is a problem. It's better than nothing, but it is not the solution long term. And, of course, Medicaid coverage is part of the ACA that we're talking about here. So, the problem is the cost, the runaway cost. The quality is not improving. 27th, in advanced economies in terms of quality of coverage here. It does not solve the problem. And we could save, as you pointed out, $1 trillion a year. $1 trillion in terms of efficiency. $1 trillion a year. Folks should understand, Medicare is the most efficient system we've ever had for the cost. You know, you pay 1.45% of your pay, and when you hit 65 for the rest of your life, you get total coverage, you know, wherever you want to go, and it's wonderful. Medicare is a huge success. And when they talk about, oh, Medicare is in trouble financially, no, that's the prescription drug part of Medicare that's in trouble, because they never passed the tax to cover prescription drugs, and because under Part D prescription drugs, they let these drug companies charge whatever they want, runaway drug prices, and no taxes to pay for it. And yes, Part D is undermining Medicare, but Part A and Part B are the best system that's ever been created in this country as far as health coverage is concerned. And single payer is 95% the same as Medicare for All, as I understand it. What do you think of that?
Well, I think you're right, Jack. And I think Medicare has to be improved and expanded. If you look at, like, the model bill is the Conyers bill, H.R. 676. He calls for a full range of coverage, including prescription drugs and dental coverage and optical coverage, mental health protection, nursing home care, all of these things, which are kind of, they're shortchanged a bit under the current Medicare system. And as you know, that there's a huge push by the profiteers to privatize pieces of the Medicare system, and mm-hmm. that's driving some crisis in Medicare also. But, we say that you can protect Medicare by expanding it to everyone. I mean, the problem with Medicare right now is it covers the sickest portion of the population, the people over 65, and some other people who get it through access to Social Security disability benefits. If you expanded the pool of coverage to everyone in America, some of those cost issues would be moderated. In fact, I was not politically active when it was passed in 1965, but I've heard people say that one of the reasons it was able to be passed is that the private insurance company was somewhat happy to push off the most expensive mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. portion of their clients onto a public system.
And so, right.
If we don't do anything to move forward, Medicare itself, I think, will be jeopardized as, the profiteers and the austerity folks continue to chip away.
Oh, yeah, they want to privatize that as well. They want to get at that, no doubt. But, folks should understand, I've read the government Social Security and Medicare, of course, part of Social Security Trust reports for the last several years, and it's very clear, if you look at the numbers, that Part A, the hospital, and Part B, the physicians, are not in severe deficit. They are not in severe deficit. It's Part D that's the problem. And even the trustees of Social Security and Medicare have said that all you need to do is for the next 10 years to ensure 70 million baby boomers hitting Medicare, all you need to do is raise the tax, the Medicare tax, which is only 1.45%, by a 0.25.
Mm-hmm.
That's all you need to do, and you will cover all of Medicare's surge here because of the baby boomer for the next decade. 0.25, 0.25%, is all you need. And after that, Medicare costs by 2030 will start going down because, you know, all of us will die off. And, you know, the cost will go down. So there's no crisis in Medicare, Part A and B. There is a crisis in Part D, prescription drugs, because they never passed a tax. That was George Bush, you know. Oh, yep. We're going to get the credit of a health care subsidy bill for the drug companies. No one can, even the states, cannot negotiate drug plans, drug prices. You know, let them charge whatever the hell they want, the drug companies. And, you know, these are the same companies that are running overseas now and taking advantage of what's called tax inversions to avoid paying taxes. To Uncle Sam here, right? So, you know, it's not a crisis. Medicare is not in a crisis. People should know that. And single payer, being like Medicare, is easily funded. Easily funded. You know, my wife is a teacher, and people who are teachers will be amazed, and not amazed, they'll recognize this. You know how much teachers are paying, an average teacher is paying in a monthly health care insurance premium, and the school district is paying to these health insurance companies for a union negotiated plan $2,000 a month for PPO. $2,000 a month. Now that's about, you know, when you look at it, what, 15-20% of your income, and you're only paying 1.45% for Medicare? I mean, 20%? 1.45%? I mean, it's a not rocket science to figure out what's more efficient and less costly in the long run, and it's Medicare, single payer. Tell us what's going on with this conference, Mark.
Well, we're going to meet next weekend and right near you in Oakland, California. The Labor Campaign for Single Payer was launched in 2009, right before the inauguration of President Obama, and, you know, it was kind of organized to pull together a grassroots labor activism around health care justice and to insist that the labor movement take up the fight for real health care reform and move forward on single payer as every other industrialized country has. You know, we've been trying to engage the movement at both the national and the local level. A lot of the action right now has to do with these state single-payer reform campaigns. So we're holding our National Strategy Conference next weekend, at the same time, a couple of our allied groups are coming into town, a group called Healthcare Now, which is a community-based grassroots single-payer advocacy organization, and a group called One-Payer States, which is a loose coalition of state single-payer advocacy organizations will also be in town. And we will all come together for a joint meeting next Saturday afternoon, August 23rd, into noontime Sunday, the 24th.
So this is a national strategy meeting, not just a California thing.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Good. And has this been endorsed by various unions? Or is this a union participated thing, or is this just
The Labor Campaign for Single Payer is a union based organization. So, you know, we have now 15 national unions that have endorsed the Labor Campaign for Single Payer, and 10 state labor federations, and dozens of local and regional unions, including a lot of California-based unions that have endorsed us. And then the other groups are sort of community-based groups and organizational-based groups. But we're, you know, we come out of the labor movement, and our we see our special mission as engaging with the labor movement on the healthcare crisis and insisting that it take the leadership and move its organizing capacity and resources into this fight in a big way. So that's where we're coming from on this. But, you know, there's a lot of great California groups, which is one of the reasons why we're meeting in Oakland. The California Nurses Association has been at the forefront of the fight, and you know their members are, you know, really understand that, you know, as nurses they're an advocate for healthcare for all of their patients, and that the only way to do that is to fight for a just healthcare system. So they have the California nurses, the California school employees have been with us from the beginning. We're meeting at Longshore Hall, ILWU Hall, in Oakland. The Longshore Union, I think, has probably supported a single-payer solution since its founding in the 1930s, and one of the few unions that never got sucked into some of these other schemes of, you know, the Hillary Clinton health care plan and Obama's health care plan and Nixon's health care plan. They've been pretty consistent. And they're in negotiations right now, and they're dealing with some of these adverse consequences of the Affordable Care Act, and looking at, as Jack, you said in your introduction, you know, a 40% excise tax on that portion of their benefits that exceeds the maximums in the Affordable Care Act, and it's adding hundreds of millions of dollars into the cost of the negotiations.
There's just no way that unions will be able to continue health care bargaining once that 40% tax hits. I mean, you can't pass that much. Companies can't pass that much of a cost on the workers. You know,
I think they
can't afford it, and the workers can't afford it. So that, you know, this is the dusk, the end time of union negotiated plans coming here, and it raises, as I've been saying in articles I've been writing for Telesaur here, is maintenance of benefit bargaining at a strategic impasse. Maintenance of benefit, for folks listening, is about giving up wage increases in order to keep funding your health care coverage, which is what unions and workers have been doing for 15 years now. You know, you've been putting all that money into maintaining your health care coverage instead of getting wage increases, and of course wages are stagnant or falling since 2000 now, now all that money put there is for naught, because you know, the tax and everything on these plans is going to make them impossible to continue anyway. So workers have been putting up 15 years, a decade and a half of giving up wage increases to keep their benefits, and now the politicians are giving it to Deep Six. So we wasted 15 years of wage increases here. Maintenance of benefits, which is the centerpiece of union negotiating strategies, is now coming to an end, just as putting money into defined benefit pensions has almost come to an end. What you see is the social wages for benefits, you know, is being taken back. We got concessionary bargaining on the social wage, just as we've had concessionary bargaining for three decades now on the nominal wage as a focus. Now it's moving to the social wage, and the politicians are in there at the table, sitting on the side of the corporations, taking back the pay that workers have put into their benefits. So it's a big strategic crisis, I think, the unions are about to face, and got to ask themselves, well, what next for collective bargaining, if not maintenance of benefits? You know, where the hell do we go from here?
Yeah,
anyway,
union,
that's an aside.
Unions are really beginning to understand that, and I think that's why our campaign has maintained momentum over the last few years. Is, you know, they know that their days are numbered in terms of health care bargaining, and that they've got to move this into a social right. Because the other alternative is the employer plan is to turn health care into a defined contribution plan like they've done to our pensions. And the bosses are going to set up these private exchanges, similar to the state exchanges, and they're going to say, "Here's $1,000. Go buy your own health care coverage." And if you're you're a teacher in California and it costs $2,000 a month for a middle range plan, well, you know where the other $1,000 is going to come from, and that's sort of the plan. So, you know, we've been telling folks, and it's really resonating in the labor movement, that really long term, the only way to guarantee health care for your members is to guarantee it for everybody. And that's
I like the fact that your conference, as you indicated, is not just a labor conference, union conference, but it's community organizations as well, because on this topic, as in so many others, if the labor unions don't link up in a serious joint way, not a token way, not with labor leading the community, but together, everyone on an equal footing strategically and pushing the program here, it's not going to go anywhere. So it's great that great to hear that this is you got community groups from around the country who are in this particular space here, pushing this, participating in this. What do you hope to come out of this?
Well, I think there's several things. First of all, there's been a lot of experience now on the, you know, with organizing on the state level. There's been somewhat of a breakthrough in Vermont. They passed legislation a couple years ago that will put them on the road to establishing a single-payer system once it's allowed, may be allowed under the Affordable Care Act in 2017. That remains to be seen. But, you know, they've done a lot of work in Vermont on that, and you know, now of course they're under attack as the corporate healthcare industry is trying to reverse that. But some of that style of organizing, I think, is really, you know, the crucial lessons that we'll hope to get out of this conference is, how do you build the kind of movement strong enough to confront the massed corporate power at the center of our healthcare system and make the change? Because it's really not a question of coming up with the best ideas or crafting the best piece of legislation. I mean, the book has been written on most of that stuff. People know how to design a healthcare system that could provide healthcare for all. They've figured out how to pay for it. There's model legislation out there. Really, the question is, it's an organizing problem, and it's a question of power. You know, the reason we don't have health care for all in this country is because a whole bunch of large institutions make massive profits by treating it as a business. And in order to overcome that, you're going to have to build a powerful social movement. You know, labor needs to be there, but as you said, you know, it has to be part of a broader movement of community forces and patients and health care providers. And maybe even some small businesses who still have some kind of a human connection to their employees will be there in the end. And that's the kind of movement we need. And so that's the sort of lessons we hope we can discuss, and the kind of cross-fertilization that we hope will take place at the meeting next weekend.
Is the thinking among the folks who are involved in this organizing that strategically, the focus needs to be at the state level first? I mean, obviously, you know, nothing's happening at the national level here. Both wings of the corporate party are at odds with each other on passing anything. So to argue, let's go for some national legislation, Medicare for all, you know, right away raises the very obvious criticism that, well, gee, you can't even get food stamps passed, so how are you going to get this passed? So does that mean that the strategy, the better strategy, perhaps, is going at it at certain state levels and building the state support for this? I mean, kind of like, you know, the national amendments to the Constitution. If you go at it state by state and build state support and add more states to it, then pretty soon it becomes a national issue and it's easier to pass nationally. So am I correct in thinking
I think there's a range of views, Jack, and we're going to kind of talk that through. But I would say that the sort of the emerging consensus, and I don't want to speak for everybody, but you know, is, you know, trying to think about how we move forward in this current period. Ideally, there should be one national bill, national funding. It's a lot easier to run it as a national health care system. You know, the sort of the ability to raise money nationally is a lot easier. You don't get the questions of, you know, people hiding their money and moving it from state to state and having all of these divergent financing systems and things like that. And, you know, the system isn't, you know, the healthcare system is integrated now nationally. And, you know, it'd just be more rational to do it. But as you said, that's not going to happen. You know, there's just no conceivable path that in the next few years, you know, we could emerge, you know, with a national healthcare bill. So how do you keep the movement going forward? That's really the question. And so people are saying in states where it's conceivable that you could do this, that is states that, you know, have a fairly well-organized progressive and labor-based movements and this kind of politics that might engage in doing that, that perhaps if we can break through and begin to establish these systems on a state level in a few places, that will build the momentum to allow us to come back into the national framework. And, you know, a lot of it, very similar to sort of the dynamics of marriage equality, where, you know, the first breakthroughs came in, you know, localities and states, but it created such a powerful momentum that, you know, any day now there will be, you know, a national recognition of marriage equality. And, you know, so that's sort of the broad range of thinking. So, but, you know, there are some difficulties in trying to build it state by state, you know, not least of which is we leave our brothers and sisters in huge sections of the country behind us. You know, our friend, you know, comrades in the South, you know, cannot conceive of a short-term path forward for a state single-payer campaign. They can't even get their mean-spirited state governments to accept the expansion of Medicaid at almost no cost to the states in those states, much less think about a dynamic movement for health care. But, you know, the idea is to fight where you can to move it forward. That's how they won it in Canada. They won it first in the province of Saskatchewan, moved it to several other provinces, and then established the Medicare Act in Canada nationally. And that's really, you know, where a lot of people's efforts are. I think labor in some of the key states is moving in that direction. We'd love to see California lead the pack on this. We win it in California. I think we win it nationally because it's such a, you know, powerful driver of the national economy.
Yeah, I think, you know, your point there about California is very apropos here. But the problem is, didn't we have a bill in California that was introduced and Governor Brown in the Democratic wing of the corporate party vetoed it or tabled it or something?
Yeah, well, you passed the bill twice when Schwarzenegger was governor and he vetoed it. And then for some reason, you know, when you had a Democratic supermajority in both houses, and a Democratic governor who I seem to recall has historically supported single payer, for some reason you couldn't get a bill submitted by anyone. And so he's sort of in limbo here. I think there's a debate about how to move forward in California. A lot of the union folks think that it's really got to go the initiative route and are, you know, thinking about what kind of resources would need to be in the room to make that happen. But, you know, that's the problem with all of these fundamental reforms is, you know, if you rely on the sort of inside politics of, you know, your friends in the Democratic Party, it always seems like you fall one vote short when the time comes to do something.
Yeah, or the initiative process, even if you win, corporations with all their money will tie it up in courts for years.
Yeah, well, you know.
It's more of a, you know, it's okay as a tactic, I think, the initiative process, because it brings attention to it and raises people's consciousness of the importance of it, but people should have no illusions that that's the route for implementing it. You know, what we really need to do is put pressure on these legislatures in various means, the movement, to accept it, or else, if you don't, we'll run a candidate against you whose program is to pass it. You know, that's the only way you put the fear of God into some of these legislators. Otherwise, they'll just play their party politics and log roll and horse trade this for that, and in the end, you know, you come out the short end of it. Anyway, it's going to be interesting to see what the strategic, you know, choices are. Is this like sort of an important conference coming up here for strategic shift, you think, or for new initiatives, or you know, how would you describe the hopes of coming out of this conference going forward compared to where we've been up to this point?
I think within the labor movement, and I think it's probably true in other social movements, but I'm, you know, can't really speak for all of them. But, you know, certainly within the labor movement, we are very close to reaching critical mass in terms of understanding how important it is to finish the job and keep moving forward on the single-payer front. It's important, as we've discussed earlier, not just because it's an absolute good to have health care as a right, but it's part of this whole project of beginning to advance working class interests, to take on these to come up with an alternative to the austerity attacks on working people, and to build the kind of social movement that'll build power for working people. So it's important in a number of different ways. And there's beginning to be, you know, almost the point where we can move it forward, and my hope is that we come out of this much stronger and much closer to that moment when labor will really wake up and make this an organizational priority at all levels of the labor movement. So that's sort of my vision for the work that we have to do at this meeting, and then, you know, to build out those ties with our allies in the communities, you know, is so important. Build those relationships, you know, to get people to, even just to have people, you know, from the same municipality, you know, to sit down together and, you know, look at the problem from their different perspectives. Just so important to do that.
You know, one of the opposition arguments to this whole idea of single payer has always been, oh, it's too expensive, employers can't afford it, so on and so forth. Has anyone been doing any kind of a economic analysis position paper showing how it would actually be less costly to implement single payer? Let's take in California, for example.
Well,
as people know, in California, you've got employers have to pay an unemployment tax, insurance tax. They have to pay a disability tax. You know, the workers pay part, and they pay part, and that's a certain percentage of their income, you know, the SDI and disability insurance and the unemployment insurance. They pay a tax all the time. What if we had a social insurance tax where, you know, we would include health care in that? And yes, the employers would pay more for that social insurance tax, you know, but then they wouldn't have to pay their contribution, their share of the contribution to the insurance company. I mean, you know, someone should do a cost analysis here to show that this thing would not only be more efficient in terms of coverage, uninsured and for insured, but it would lower the cost to both employers and to workers if we had single payer.
Yeah, there is a bunch of people who are working on that. There's an economist named Gerald Friedman from the University of Massachusetts who will be with us in Oakland. He'll be speaking at the One Payer States Group and then joining the joint meeting, who's actually done some studies. I don't think he's done in California, but he's done a study for Vermont and Maryland and Pennsylvania, and maybe one or two other states, and kind of broken those numbers down about what it would cost and where the money could come from. And then, you know, in California, the California school employees have actually done some interesting work where they've taken a look at school budgets and looked at how much they're currently allocating for health care for their active and retired employees and how much they might pay under a funding scheme, you know, similar to the health care bills that have been submitted in California. And, you know, looking at, you know, huge savings for school districts around the state. And healthcare now has a similar campaign called the Win-Win Campaign, where they try to take a look at municipal budgets and look at the healthcare costs and compare it to what they would pay under a single-payer financing system. And again, it's just massive, the amounts of money that you could transfer from, you know, the pockets of these healthcare profiteers into, you know, incredible social benefits for people.
Yeah, people should understand these health insurance companies that are getting filthy rich off of this rentier, as we call it, an economics profits engine that they have. These are really finance companies. You know, they take your contributions, and what do? They invest in derivatives. They invest in foreign exchange. You know, they're big international banking companies, shadow banking companies. And what's their biggest binge now? You know, United Healthcare, Anthem, all these guys. They're running around the world buying up using the premiums we pay. Extra premiums to buy up competitors around the world. That's what they're doing with this money, you know. And to do it, they got to get loans from Wall Street. And Wall Street says, well, you're going to have a 20% return, which means they got to suck off 20% of all the contributions that are paid, which means that they got to hold down the access to healthcare services for us, why we pay more, so they can go out and buy these companies from around the world. That's what's going on now. So, you know, these aren't health insurance companies anymore. These are big international bankers that we're dealing with, and we ought to get them the hell out of the picture. We don't need them. You don't need the bankers. You know, you don't even need the bankers in the banking system. We could have public banking and take the profit out of banking here because they're bloodsuckers, and they're squeezing us, and you know, they're using it for their global plans, and they're sucking money out of us right and left in every direction. We got to deprivatize this. We got, as you said at the beginning, we got to make this a public good. We got to treat this like, electricity delivery, right? Well, we got utility companies, only one instead of multiple utility companies. You know, a century ago, we used to have four or five electric and gas generation companies in every city. Well, that was inefficient, overcharging everybody. So we only have one. That's what we should do. We should have one, a single payer for delivering a public good called health care. That's just my 10 cents on this thing. Tell us some websites where people can go to for more information, you know, about the conference, about the movement, about the union side of the movement, the community side of the movement. Give the audience some information here if you can, Mark.
Sure. Our website is laborforsinglepayer.org, and it has some information about the Oakland conference right at the top of the website. The other organization, Healthcare Now, is healthcare-now.org, and has a number of interesting facts on that website. The other website I think is always very useful is the Physicians for National Health program. They've done, you know, keep track of all of the different developments in the healthcare policy world and outcomes and stuff like that, and there's always interesting material to be found on that, and that is pnhp.org. And then, you know, a number of the labor movement sponsors have include some good healthcare activist information on their sites. I know that the nurses do. I think it's nationalnursesunited.org. I don't have that site in front of me, Jack, but
okay.
If you Google California Nurses Association or National Nurses United, I know they have a whole section on their site devoted to labor and healthcare justice issues.
Mm-hmm. Will they, at the conference, will people be discussing the current state of affairs of the effort in Vermont?
Oh, yeah, we're going to have some folks from Vermont with us. We're going to have an organizer from the Vermont Workers Center, which is a statewide grassroots organizations that was instrumental in passing the bill, and then we are going to have one of the state legislature's tours from Vermont, a young woman named Keisha Rahm. She is the youngest state legislator in the country and the only person of color in the Vermont state legislature, and she's on the Ways and Means Committee, and they're figuring out how to pay for health care in Vermont, and so she will be there also.
Now, is this an open conference for local people here in the Bay Area might want to attend, or is this just organizations for a, you know, strategy?
The Healthcare Now conference is open for anybody who wants to attend, and you can register for it on the Healthcare Now website.
Where would they go for that?
Healthcare-now.org.
Okay, healthcare-now.org. This is for the conference coming up starting Friday night, next Friday night. That's what, the 22nd, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if people locally here in the Bay Area, or if you're visiting, want to attend that, go to healthcare-now.org, and you'll get all the information you want to sign up, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, very good. All right. So in a few minutes we have left, you want to sum up and say what you think are the important points that need to be made for the audience here regarding this topic?
Well, I think we pretty much covered it, Jack. I mean, I think the healthcare crisis is undiminished. It's going to continue to play out. The Affordable Care Act, while increasing some access to healthcare for people and, you know, moving forward in some ways, is in no way a long-term solution to that crisis. We've got to move to a system that treats healthcare as a right. That'll open up all kinds of other possibilities. If you could think of, you know, the single thing to make life better for working people in this country, I think you might want to start with making healthcare a right. Just changes so many things for people. The way we're going to do this is not by playing inside politics, but by building a powerful social movement to force the political machines to move in this direction and to enact health care for all. We got to deal with a whole series of institutional roadblocks right now, and we're looking at strategic options to do that. And labor is waking up and is hopefully about to take up its historic mission to lead this fight for health care justice.
Yeah, labor is coming off of a great strategic detour. Yeah. You know, it was in the late 40s. Up until that time, labor was all for national health care. Mm-hmm. And that's part of Social Security. And when Social Security was first passed in the late 30s, by the way, it was passed only because we had a nationwide movement of Social Security clubs. I mean, the Democratic Party did not at first embrace this, and even Roosevelt opposed it. And it was these clubs that were organized around the country that were really instrumental for forcing Social Security to be included as part of the New Deal, which it eventually was under Roosevelt. But at first, the Democrats and Roosevelt opposed it. That's a little bit of history people should know, right? But then, you know, the whole idea was to pass it for retirement, and after the war, World War II, the idea was to add Medicare to it. Well, labor went into a big detour, and government sort of provided incentives and pushed it to go into negotiating a union employer health care plans. In other words, on an individual union by union basis. Now that's coming to an end. Union provided health care is coming to an end. So now labor maybe is going to return to its historic mission here to really push health care for everybody, for all working people in this country. I sure hope so. As you've talked about, it's back to a union community alliance, and raising new questions about what does that need to look like going forward here. Mark, I really want to thank you for bringing this attention to folks interested. Laborforsinglepayer.org, healthcare-now.org, Physicians for National Health Program, PNHP.org, and hopefully some folks local here will attend the conference. Mark, I want to have you back talk about a Labor Party some point.
Man, I'd love to do that.
Okay, we'll do that. Thank you all listening, audience. This is Alternative Visions. Next week, my economic predictions for the coming year and analysis of my last year's predictions.